Welcome to Outlandish Voices, the podcast, made possible by Vox FM. I'm your host, Laura Gooden. Today's story is Nasty Little Habits, written and read by Rob Hood.
The day Warwick's mother killed her only son, it was cold and drizzly, the sort of day in which to die was as good a way of passing the time as staring disconsolately out the window. Warwick was 10 and very noisy. He yelled a lot, even when he didn't have anything intelligible to say, which was most of the time, and when he wasn't yelling, he was bashing things. A ruler against the wall, for example, spoons against a cup brim, pieces of doweling against the doorframe, or he'd tap, with his fingernails, on the tabletop, endlessly. His mother would berate him, and he'd look offended. After all, he wasn't aware he was doing anything obnoxious, wriggling about, babbling and hitting things were just something you did when you didn't have anything else to do, like watching TV. And the trouble with TV was that his mother and his father hated the old 24-inch set being on at all, particularly when Warwick wanted to watch a loud, aggressive cartoon adventure. They made him turn it off, so he'd squirm. What else was there to do? "For God's sake, sit still," his mother would scream. "Sorry?" Warwick looked up, perplexed. He'd been thinking about gunning down mechanoids from outer space and was unconsciously mimicking their death jerks and popping his lips in a way that sounded a bit like laser blasts. "You were twitching about and making that infernal bloody noise." "No, I wasn't." "Yes, you were." Warwick's mother was about the size of a mechanoid, though she was soft and round rather than angular and metallic, and Warwick fantasized gunning her down. "See," she yelled, "you're doing it again." "No, I wasn't." "You were." She leaned across at him and belted him on the side of his head. "Don't lie to me. Get to your room, you little jerk." She always sent him to his room, which he hated. It was full of toys and books and furniture he was allowed to climb about on, but he always found it boring. He'd sit in the middle of the floor, imagining the grossest thing he could think of and picking his nose, and in a minute or two he'd be bored. There was no one there, no one he could make noises at. The room didn't sigh, or wrinkle up the newspaper, or rub its hand over its eyes. It never exploded like an overfull balloon, and it never sent him away. He couldn't communicate with his room. "There's nothing in there to do," he complained. "I don't care." His mother was glaring intensely, her skin flushed red. "If you can't control your nasty little habits in my presence, then you can bloody well indulge them in your own. Just make sure I can't hear it." Warwick's parents accused him of having lots of nasty little habits, picking his nose abstractedly, for example, then leaving what he'd scavenged on the coffee table or smeared along the arm of the lounge. Sometimes he'd scratch his bottom and fart. This would make him laugh. Another nasty habit was dropping his clothes wherever he was when he took them off, which was mostly in the hallway, outside the bathroom, or in front of the TV. Or he'd drink straight out of the family-sized Coke bottles and leave spit dribbling down the inside of the plastic. Often he'd take a few bites out of sandwiches or apples or bananas, get sidetracked, and toss the remains into the nearest corner. They wouldn't be found until they rotted and began to smell. Or he'd leave used glasses around the house. His father would trip over one, and then Warwick would get flogged. Warwick was never aware of doing these things, and his obtuseness was a source of utter frustration to his parents. So when they found he'd dropped squishy blobs of toothpaste on the sink, or left the toilet seat down when he'd peed and had splashed all over it, they'd act as though he was some sort of deviant and exile him to his room. "That boy has too many nasty little habits," he heard his mother say to his father one night after he was supposed to be in bed and was actually lurking outside their bedroom door. "We've got to put a stop to it." "What's he been up to now?" his father said in a tone of despair. "He keeps leaving things around the house." "Things?" "Dead things, insects, grasshoppers, and half-chewed cicadas that the cats mangled. Yuck, I hate it." "Tell him not to." "I did. He just ignores me." "I'm sure he doesn't ignore you. He's just a bit, you know, distracted. Walks around with his head firmly implanted up his bum." That amused Warwick greatly. He began to giggle, stifled it until it felt like a belch, and finally had to let it out. "What the hell, Warwick? You're supposed to be in bed," his father yelled. "I was on the way to the loo." Warwick stuck his head around the corner. His parents were in bed, his father holding the newspaper and his mother a book. They were glaring at him. "Go to bed," they screamed. As he hopped toward his room, Warwick heard his mother say, "See? That's another thing, lurking around outside our doorway, spying on us. I hate it." The first day of the school holidays was a complete washout. It was raining, cold and windy. The cat was padding around the house as though looking for a mouse it had secreted somewhere and now couldn't find. Warwick spent the first part of the morning watching TV, a channel-hopping mishmash of cartoons. Sesame Street, the Ghostbusters, Captain Muscle-Bound and the Mechanoids, and a kids' game show called How Much Can You Take? He loved them all. But at 10 o'clock, his mother made him turn off the set. "Go and do something else," she said. "I'm sick of hearing all that garbage." She was cross because she had to stay home and look after him. She could have gone out. Warwick wouldn't have minded at all, but she had this idea he was irresponsible. She thought he'd wreck the house or something while she was away. So she stayed home, getting more and more anxious and more disagreeable, refusing to go out with Warwick because he was too embarrassing in public. He drove her even madder in the supermarket than he did at home. "I haven't got anything to do," Warwick complained. "You've got a room full of toys and books. For God's sake, Warwick, relying on the TV for your entertainment is a really bad habit to get into." He tried to entertain himself with toys and books, tried really hard, but by 11 was all played out. Before he knew it, he was standing next to his mother, who was reading a Cosmopolitan in the lounge room. "What is it?" she said, looking up. "Nothing," she continued reading, her eyes darting nervously from the page to Warwick like little fishes caught in the shadow of a looming fossicker. "Well, what are you standing there for? Drives me crazy. Can I watch TV?" "No, go and find something to do in your room." "There isn't anything. Go outside then. It's raining. Aren't there any friends you can hang out with?" This was a stupid question, and she knew it. Warwick had no friends because he was too much of a pain, always wanting everything to go his way, always wrecking other kids' toys because he was so careless and clumsy, and always injuring someone because he got carried away and leapt on them, pretending they were a beanbag or twisting their arm until they screamed. Warwick didn't bother answering his mother's question. His eyes filled with tears. "Oh, for God's sake," Warwick's mother slammed down the magazine. "Tears aren't going to make me change my mind. If you can't occupy yourself for 5 minutes without getting bored, it's your own problem. I've got better things to do than listen to you whimpering about the place." She got up and stalked from the room. After a moment or two, Warwick heard the sound of pots and pans being tossed around in the kitchen. He quietly picked a big wad of snot from his nose and secreted it between pages 62 and 63 of his mother's magazine. Half an hour later, Warwick was in his room, miming World War III, when his mother came raging in and cuffed his right ear. He screamed, "What was that for?" "For being a dirty little beast." She whopped his other ear. "And that's for making so much bloody noise." She turned and left him bawling, but in a few minutes, when he settled down, Warwick heard her on the phone. She was sobbing. "I can't stand it," she was saying. "One day into the school holidays and I hate him already. I wasn't cut out to be a mother. It's driving me crazy. Why aren't you here, Jim? It's your fault. You haven't brought him up right." Warwick smiled to himself. They had lunch in sullen silence. At least his mother was sullen and silent, though Warwick kept babbling on so much that his mum finally cried out and dashed into her bedroom, slamming the door after her. When Warwick asked if she was okay, she screamed and threw a heavy object at the door. After that, the afternoon proceeded pretty much like the morning. His mother's voice got louder and louder and more hysterical. At 3 o'clock, Warwick went into the kitchen to get himself a sandwich. A few minutes later, his mother went in to make a cup of tea and came out again immediately, screaming. Just because he'd left the lids off the Vegemite, the honey, 3 different types of jam and the butter, and had dropped a bit of each of these substances onto the benchtop and the floor. He'd also dirtied 5 knives and 6 plates and had broken a glass. His mother cut her bare foot on the shards. "What have I done?" Warwick cried while his mother beat him. "You're a monster," she screamed. "You were sent to drive me mad, weren't you? Admit it." Warwick cried some more. Finally, his mother stopped hitting him. She watched him for a moment as he writhed about on the floor, sobbing. He looked like a sea-racked jellyfish, quivering miserably as it died, dragging itself pitifully toward the surf and freedom. But unlike the jellyfish, Warwick would live. And she would go on being tormented, probably forever. "I'm going to the shops," she said at last, her voice brittle but dispassionate. "You can stay here and torment the cat instead of me for all I care." She grabbed her bag and the car keys and was out the door in an instant. Warwick heard the car start, and the sound seemed so terminal he was filled with fear and desperation. She might leave him forever. She might pick up his father. Together they might escape to Bermuda. Who would he talk to then? Who would look after him? He'd be alone with a cat, and the cat wasn't any fun at all. "Mummy!" he yelled. He heard his mother's car as it backed along the driveway. Warwick rushed out the front door, waving for her to stop. "Don't go, Mummy!" he screamed. The car rushed toward him, his mother's face red in the rearview mirror. Surely she wouldn't leave him standing crying like this. She must have seen him. He waved frantically. Fumes stung his nostrils. "Mum!" he began, and the aging Ford Falcon knocked him down. Its wheels rolled over him, squirting his blood across the concrete. Warwick was dead, and he hadn't felt a thing. "I didn't do it on purpose, Jim," Warwick's mother, Grace, moaned yet again. Warwick's father raised his eyebrows and sighed. "I swear I didn't." "I know, dear. So you've said. I believe you." "Do you? Do you really, Jim? I hope so." It was a week after the terrible tragedy. The suddenness and the extremity of it had led to rumours that Warwick's mother simply cracked and disposed of Warwick in one final and decisive act of self-preservation. She hadn't been charged with anything, but then there was more than one way to skin the law, or so some said, and Warwick's father, Jim Badger, whose work had something to do with politics, had probably got her off. Not that the neighbours were sorry to hear of Warwick's accident. They considered such an end only to be expected from a child as uncivilised as Warwick. They hadn't seen him much, but what interaction they had had with him convinced them he was ill-mannered and uncouth, if not downright disgusting. He made them feel content with their own gracious and well-brought-up offspring. Of course it was terrible that any child should be taken in such a way, but if one had to be taken, it was comforting to know it was a child like Warwick that drew the short straw. "I feel just awful," Grace said. Jim rustled the newspaper nervously. He'd started the week convinced that his wife was completely innocent. Now he wasn't so sure. Vague suspicions had begun to suggest themselves, not least of which was the suspicion that he didn't really mind that Warwick wasn't around any more. It was terrible that the boy had had to die, of course, and so horribly. But, you know, life was beginning to seem rather peaceful. And in the long run, peace of mind was important, wasn't it? Warwick had certainly had his faults. In fact, for a while, life did seem easier for the Badgers. There was less cleaning to do, less anxiety and tension, fewer expenses, and so much peace and quiet that they frequently slept in of a morning and had evening dinners that were serene, leisurely, and civilized. They only had to tidy the house once or twice a fortnight, and Warwick's room made an excellent study. Grace got a job she liked and Jim got a promotion, principally because his superior, the local MP, felt sorry for him over his sad loss. Grace and Jim were getting on much better than they had been when Warwick was alive. If they had any nasty little habits, they shared them and were not bothered by them in the least. It was only when Jim Badger caught himself actually feeling grateful that he developed a nagging sense of guilt. And guilt made him short-tempered and careless. "What the hell are these beer glasses doing behind the lounge?" Jim yelled one wet, dreary evening that reminded Grace of that awful day when she'd run over her son. She glanced up. Her husband was holding three dirty glasses, a scowl on his face. She shrugged. "What do you mean you don't know?" he growled. "You must have put them there." "Me? I don't drink beer." "I was going to ask you about that. Have you been getting into my beer?" "Of course not." "Is your lover getting into my beer then?" "Jim, how can you say that?" "Well, I didn't put them there." "How long have they been there, then?" Jim took a closer look, screwing up his face to sniff the rancid dregs. "Yuck," he growled. "Look, just try and be a bit tidier, for God's sake. I hate finding old glasses lying around the house. That was one of Warwick's bloody tricks." It was only then that Grace noticed a smear of lumpy yellow substance on the edge of the table. The sight made her heart pound more rapidly and sweat break out on her palms. She gasped. What's up with you? Her husband said. Nothing. You look sick. It's nothing. I don't feel well. Then go to bed early, dear. You seem to be losing it. He wandered off into his study. Unwilling to be left alone in the lounge room, Grace went to bed, hoping things would seem clearer in the morning. Later, Grace heard strange sounds in the hall. She woke up from a light doze to sounds like groaning boards, as though someone was sneaking up to their doorway, lurking within earshot the way Warwick used to. "Who's there?" she whispered, shivering. She thought she heard a snicker, low and breathy. "Is that you, Jim?" There was no answer, only breathing, and the peculiar gurgling noise Warwick made whenever he was trying to hold back a laugh. "Who is it?" she screamed. Whoever it was at the doorway turned and shuffled off. Grace heard the thump-bang disappearing down the hall toward the kitchen. A few moments later, Jim stuck his head around the corner and scared the hell out of her. "What's the matter with you?" he said crossly. "What's all the bloody screaming? Were you lurking outside the door?" "When?" "Just now." "Of course not. What do you take me for?" "You having some sort of breakdown, dear?" "Well, I wish you wouldn't sneak up on me." "I didn't. I just came in here to see what you were making so much noise about." Grace hunkered down into the blankets. "A nightmare. Are you coming to bed?" Jim shook his head and sighed like a man oppressed by worries. "Okay, okay. Anything for peace." Grace hardly slept at all that night. Odd popping noises kept her awake, and once, just as she was drifting into a hot, disturbed doze, she thought she heard someone fart loudly and giggle. Next morning, Grace slept in. When she finally dragged herself out of bed, Jim had gone to work. There were dirty breakfast plates discarded on every surface, and to her horror, jars of peanut butter and honey and several varieties of jam left open on the bench. A different knife had been used for each one. Globs of food were spattered about the floor. "Warwick!" she yelled, furious. Then she remembered and began to cry. She rang the place where she worked and said she was ill. She tried to get some sleep. It was hopeless. Even though she managed to drift off once or twice, part of her was tense with an irrational expectation that Warwick would be coming home, as he always had, at 3:30, after school. Eventually, she started cleaning the house instead, but the pieces of mouldy pizza she found and the half-eaten sandwiches, beer bottles smeared with what looked like phlegm, the cigarette butts... Jim doesn't smoke, she thought. But what about Warwick? Had he taken up that nasty little habit as well? These discoveries terrorized her and left her trembling. When Jim finally got home, late, she was so strung out that her first reaction was to shout at him for traipsing mud over the carpet. "Wasn't me," he yelled. "Who else would it be?" Her eyes were so smudged with tears she couldn't focus on his shoes clearly enough to see whether or not they were dirty. In the early hours of the morning, Grace woke up, overwhelmed by the same feelings of disquiet, even terror, that had oppressed her during the night. Maybe it was her period. It was that time of the month. In fact, she was overdue. She tried to snuggle against Jim for comfort and found he wasn't there. His side of the bed was cold. "Jim?" she said, unnerved. From the lounge room wafted the dim cacophony of the TV. "What's the TV doing on?" she wondered. Surely Jim wasn't watching it. She eased out of bed, pulled on a robe, and crept along the hall to the lounge room door. Her stomach was in knots. Afraid of possibilities she didn't dare let form in her mind. Jim hated the early morning cartoons, had always hounded Warwick with puritanical zeal about them, calling him all sorts of names and punishing him for every insignificant misdemeanor by curtailing his viewing time. Jim wouldn't be watching TV at 7 o'clock in the morning. Only Warwick did that. Only Warwick left dirty glasses lying around. Only Warwick lurked outside their bedroom doors snickering. Only Warwick traipsed mud through the house. But how could Warwick be doing these things? Warwick was dead. The explanation terrified her. She had always deep down believed in ghosts, especially vengeful ones. She suddenly knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that that was what she was dealing with here. Warwick had returned, vicious with ectoplasmic hatred, to mete out her punishment, to continue the torment that heaven had decreed for her 10 years ago when she'd missed a period and realized she was pregnant. He would be with her always now because how could she kill a ghost? He would be there morning and night, filling the house with the litter of his nasty habits. down through long years to her, no doubt, lingering death. She pictured herself caught in an eternal bind, unable to escape, no longer waiting for Warwick to grow up and leave home because she knew he never would, never could, but going on and on and on forever. TV mood music blared at her through the half-closed door to the lounge room. "We'll see," she hissed. She pushed on the cold wood panel. The room was darkened, but light spilt from the television screen like bile, making the carpet and the furniture sickly. Warwick's father was seated on the lounge, ignoring her, absorbed in the cartoons. No Warwick anywhere. "Thank God," she whispered, dismissing her superstitions. "No Warwick, just her earthly, if peculiar, husband." But even as she felt relief slacken her tense muscles, a new worry niggled at her. What was this man doing here? He hated the early morning cartoons, hated the gaudy colours, the mindless plots, the sibilant voices, hated everything about them, especially hated those like Warwick who wasted their time watching the endless drivel. Yet here he was, watching it. "What in God's name are you doing up this early," she said, "and watching this rubbish?" Warwick's father didn't reply. His eyes were glued to the screen. "Jim?" Annoyed, she went towards him. "Don't ignore me, Jim Badger. Who do you think you are?" He looked at her then, and she knew she'd been right in the first place. The manic eyes, the slackness around the jaw, the air of insolent and false regret. Warwick's, all of them. This wasn't her husband. It was Warwick. She backed away. He watched her for a moment, then returned his attention to the screen where a mechanoid was being disintegrated by the uniformed hero's cosmic mind power. "I find I quite like this stuff," he said. The voice, too, was Warwick's. Inhibition shattered in Warwick's mother then. She reached out for something, a metallic sculpture sitting on the sideboard, a naked lady holding a small globe of the world in her outstretched hands, and felt her fingers grip tightly around the base. Quickly she brought it around in a wide arc and beat her husband's head to a pulp. She was free at last. She sat in the room afterwards, splattered with blood and gore and tiny bits of glass from the smashed TV screen, and thought, "This is Warwick's fault. Another dead thing around the house. Where does it end?" A week later, under psychiatric care while awaiting trial, she remembered that her period still hadn't come, and finally wept uncontrollably.
That was Nasty Little Habits, written and read by Rob Hood. Find out more about Rob on his website, www.roberthood.net. Thank you for listening to Outlandish Voices, the podcast, made possible by Vox FM. This podcast was produced by Laura Gooden. Original music by Houston Dunleavy. Find us on Facebook. Search for Outlandish Voices, the podcast. See you next time.